Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Mark Apolio Show. For just a moment of seriousness, Rick, this is about the healthcare workers that were murdered in Pakistan and also in Nigeria while trying to vaccinate for polio. Poliomyelitis, an acute viral disease, causes inflammation of the spinal cord and the brain. 90% of the time, no symptoms at all. But about 1% of the cases, you can have lifelong muscle weakness and paralysis. Back in 1988, the World Health Assembly felt they could eradicate polio by the year 2000. There were 350,000 polio cases every year at that time. We are down to 16 polio cases by March 27th of 2013 for the entire year. The problem is there are three countries we cannot eradicate it, Afghanistan, Nigeria, and Pakistan, and these female polio workers trying to vaccinate in Pakistan, and 9 were killed on December 2012, 7 more on New Year's Day of 2013 in Pakistan trying to vaccinate people against polio. February, 9 female healthcare workers were killed in Nigeria. And the problem is, Rick, that there was a boycott of the polio vaccine in Nigeria, and it led to polio outbreaks in 20 different countries.
Right.
So we're sitting here trying. We have the ability. We have the technology. We have the ability to eradicate polio, and yet we are not able to do it because of political reasons. And here, healthcare workers are actually giving their lives in order to try to eradicate polio. And it's a sad thing. I think we as a society, we as a humankind can do better than this.
I don't even know what to say, Tony. It's just sad that healthcare workers got to be targeted like that.
I agree. Special thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and to talk about our website and our online presence from the University of Kentucky, I am welcoming UK service owner for telephony, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. Sometimes we say .org. They're there. There's a few of them there in MP3 format. Listen to the last four or five shows. They're this to there. You know what's also there is all the other wonderful MSPR shows, both the nationwide shows and the local shows. So certainly check out WMKY.org. If you want to get more into the written type of Health Matters, go to Facebook, do a search for HM Radio Show or Health Matters Radio Show. You will find the page. Look for the logo. Jump on the page, shoot us a message, make a comment, give us some idea of show topics you might like to see, or, hey, you can tell us anything you want. No guarantee we're going to respond, but, you know, we usually check it and post some things, maybe some articles about the information we bring out on the show, or some factoid or research piece that comes out in between shows that we think is worthy of investigation or reading. So certainly jump on over to Facebook, facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Tattoo Safety, Tattoo Tips. Remember to think before you ink.
Are you going to get another one, Tony?
I am not a tattoo guy.
Really? Thought I would have guessed you for three or four.
No, just don't particularly. I mean, creating a work of art and covering it up doesn't make sense. Not covering it up.
Yeah, but you run around all the time without your shirt.
My wife misspelled, said I'm built like a Greek good. I don't know what that means.
A Greek good.
This is from Guido Zani, who's a psychologist and health systems consultant based in Alexandria, Virginia. He actually wrote this for PharmacyTimes.com, and then it got picked up by U.S. News and World Report. We've modified it a little bit to give you, and we will, in our second fractional portion, give you our top 10 tattoo tips, do's and don'ts. But first, this time, we just want to talk in general about tattoos. 21% of adults have tattoos. 36% of your 18 to 25-year-olds have them. This seems very basic to me. Tattoos are created with a machine that acts like a sewing machine, piercing needles into the skin repeatedly. Not a fun thing.
Keep on going. It's got to be worse. It injects ink.
That's right.
Instead of leaving some thread down there, it actually injects you with ink.
Some of the ink derived from automobile body paint, some created actually for the purpose of tattoos. Tattoo inks vary in color. Red, green, and yellow are the most popular. Incidentally, red, green, and yellow are the ones that are the hardest to remove.
I would have thought that black would have been a very common color, too, because a lot of them are outlined in black, or they at least start the drawing off in like a black, almost a primer.
But yeah, I understand. I don't know if black's a color in terms of popularity for their purposes or not, but I have, you know, obviously we see a lot of red, and I think red and green, not as much yellow in the ones that I've seen, but red and green are pretty common. couple of points about getting a tattoo. First of all, even if they use sterile needles, the tattoo site can become infected. Sometimes bacteria will contaminate the ink. There have been ink samples that were actually shipped contaminated. Others remain open at the tattoo parlor and get contaminated. You can get a red rash, swelling, and pain, and that will be a sign of an infection, generally 2 to 3 weeks after you get the tattoo. There are some infections that do not respond to typical antibiotics, and they can smolder along for quite a while, and you may need to get specialty help with that. If the tattoo artist reuses needles used on other people, they can, like any needle, can infect you with HIV or hepatitis. Not common, but possible.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I would think most reputable tattoo, doesn't that sound funny, a reputable tattoo parlor?
It does absolutely not sound funny at all because, yeah, there are reputable places.
There are, absolutely. But I mean, a reputable place, they clean their needles and you don't have any worries about any kind of issues like that. Now, back 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, that had to be a much larger problem.
Yep. If you can have an allergy to the ink, particularly, first of all, you will find that out obviously when you get tattooed.
If you had an allergy to the ink, what would you have to do? You can't get the ink out, right?
No, you really can't. And that allergy, by the way, could occur even months after the tattoo. I think the first thing, obviously, we have some anti-allergy medicines. We try to limit it. But, yeah, you might eventually have to have the tattoo removed as best you can to limit the allergic response. Hopefully you don't have that. The other thing you need to know is, though, conditions like psoriasis, and if you are a person who has a pretty heavy scar formation, you can get a scar from the tattoo itself. If you have an underlying skin condition, it'd be good to talk with your doctor before you decide on a tattoo.
Well, Tony, I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest you don't have a whole lot of personal experience with tattoos.
Nope. I am reading from the experts.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you. I went through the process when I was in the Army, as most young soldiers were prone to do. And I guess, really, I never thought it through. I mean, typical of a teenager. I think I was 19. It leaves. I mean, when they do that, I had one about maybe 4 inches in diameter. You don't really think about what happens after they're done, but they've basically broke open the top part of your skin wherever they're injecting the ink for the entire surface area of the tattoo. So I didn't realize the next day I woke up with one gigantic scab. I mean, it is one huge open sore. And it was, I don't want to say it was that painful because I'm a tough guy, but it hurt.
Recommendations are to remove the bandage after 24 hours, keep the area clean, apply moisturizer several times a day, avoid direct sunlight on a new tattoo because it can fade the ink. We'll talk more about do's and don'ts of getting a tattoo in our second fractional portion.
So, Tony, let's make a pact.
Well, if you make a tattoo pact, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to do it.
Well, how many shows does Health Matters have to do before you'll get a tattoo?
Probably a couple million.
Come on. Where's your loyalty and dedication to the show?
When you look like I do, you don't need anything that might make you uglier. Yeah,
I mean,
I can't go down any further.
We're on show 520 something. I mean, why can't we say, okay, at 900?
As long as we go off the air. I mean, what will happen then is I'll guarantee
899 will be the last show.
That's the last show. I have no interest in that at all.
I think that's a good Facebook post. Tell us how many shows we need to have before Tony should get a tattoo.
Listen, I will take an ink pen and I'll make a dot on my wrist if that's what you want. But that's about as far as I go. Our sponsor, Tattoo Tips.
I've got 400 shows to convert you.
Think before you ink, and I have certainly thought a long time about this.
I don't think you thought very much.
We start off with zipper injuries. I'm sure this will catch everyone's attention.
And you only gave us 4 minutes for this?
The zipper was designed in the 1800s. A guy named Gideon Sunback created the modern zipper in 1913, originally marketed as a fastener for children's clothes because of its ease of use. However, due to their location, trouser zips, as the article indicates, account for a significant portion of manly part injuries. So we are talking about manly part injuries from trouser zips.
And you elected to bring this on the show how?
The National Electronic
Is this hitting home with you or something, Tony?
Injury surveillance. I read the literature. I report. You don't ask the news anchor if he's been attacked by a rocket-propelled grenade. He just reports the news.
Maybe he has. Maybe it just feels that
maybe
way.
Maybe he's not saying. The National Electronic Injury Surveillance System, this is a electronic surveillance from about 100 representative U.S. hospitals on injuries operated by the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And what they did was they just queried the NEISS, asked them how many zipper injuries have these representative ERs seen in the past year. And they actually looked not only for the past year, but from 2002 to 2010, a period of 8 years. The 100 ERs saw almost 2,700 actual cases. You extrapolate that nationwide if these were a representative sample, and maybe these ERs just happen to see a lot of zipper injuries, but if they're representative.
We have ERs that specialize in zipper injuries?
I don't think so.
Is that what you just said?
If not, then 80,000 people had manly part injuries due to zippers between 2002 and 2010, and 10,000 a year present to U.S. ERs.
So how many have you seen?
I've seen a couple.
But that's in 20 years.
Oh, keep in mind, I'm not a trauma urology guy.
You're not a trouser guy?
I am just aware of a couple because I used to hang out a lot in the emergency room back when
okay.
I was working
so,
nights.
I mean, that's okay. That's All a right. big number. That's a big number.
Average age, 22 years old. Two-thirds occur in people less than 18 years old. Is that surprising to you that teenagers have more problems with the zipper to the manly part?
See, now, Tony, here's the deal. Now, mm-hmm. I suspect that if you look at the 80s, probably like from 82 to 92, somewhere around in there, you will see these numbers will not hold true because that was when the button fly came into being. And they were very popular. There were no jeans when I was in high school that had zippers on them.
Well, I wear pleated pants, as you know.
No, I don't. I really don't look.
My theory is that those pleated pants may have saved me from some embarrassing injuries because they do allow a little bit more room than others. I don't know. I'm throwing that out.
Tony,
if you have to go to the emergency room, consider pleated pants or, as Rick mentions, button flies, Velcro, something so that you never have to do this again.
This is more than likely these come from somebody trying to go a little too fast.
You know, I don't.
Just a little too fast. I'm not going to buy into the whole, okay, there's extra room. I don't know where you were going with that, but I'm not going to buy it. I think people just go too fast.
30% of all adult manly part injuries were sustained while using a trouser zip. That is the leading cause of adult ED presentation.
That's totally wrong. That's because they can't see.
Now, interestingly enough, in the pediatric age group, the zipper was the second most common mechanism for injury of the manly part. The first most common mechanism of injury was crush injuries by toilet seats. I am not making that up. I got to tell you, I can't even conceive of a visual of how this works.
I'm going to ponder that during the break.
We should. we've given our audience some
That's
very
all I'm going to do with it, too.
Assignments during a break. But take a moment to figure this out.
We'll play some nice music for you.
Play it on Facebook. Listen to the banjo music. We'll be back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Marco Polio Show. Again, our salute to the 25 healthcare workers who have been murdered in the past 12 months trying to eradicate polio in Pakistan and in Nigeria. Much due to a mistrust of Western society. Actually, in Nigeria, they boycotted the polio vaccine because they felt that it was an attempt to make them sterile by civilized countries in the West. They were trying to keep their population down, so they felt that they couldn't trust us to vaccinate them. It's sad to see such a tragedy, see young people exposing themselves to that risk because of mistrust between nations. Our sponsor for the second time is Tattoo Tips. Remember to think before you ink. And we have this fractional portion, our top 10.
Should be don't drink before you ink.
Okay. That would be part of thinking, I think. These are the top 10 do's and don'ts of getting a tattoo. Again, this came from Guido Zani, who's a psychologist and health systems consultant in Alexandria, Virginia. We adapted it for Health Matters to make our top 10 tips. There were 11, Rick, but I deleted one just to make you mad so that I've got another top 10 list.
Yeah.
Tip number one.
Okay, Dave.
Do go to a tattoo parlor that is registered and a tattoo artist who is licensed. This is not something
registered
that you
wear,
want
licensed
your
wear.
Cousin to do. This is not something that you want to get in the locker room at school.
Registered wear, licensed wear?
I'm sure there is a state license
nice.
That they have to have.
Nice.
I'm just trying to get out of it. You've nailed me to the wall here.
Yeah, because
so
I would have been easier with that 11th question.
Got it. Do ask about the ink's expiration date. Expired ink should never be used. And again, there is a higher risk of infection, theoretically, with the expired ink, so check on that. And number three, do request inks that are approved for tattoos. If the ink is diluted with water, make sure they're using sterile water. Number four, go to the doctor if you think you have an infection. Ointments provided by the tattoo parlors cannot treat a tattoo infection. A needle has been injected under the surface of your skin. The ointment cannot get to the area where the infection is likely occurring. Tip number five, inform healthcare professionals about tattoos before getting an MRI. The MRI causes some of the metallic parts of the...
to warm up.
It does. It vibrates. It warms up. And if you have a large tattoo, that can get very uncomfortable. It's like you're in a microwave. Number six, do seek a professional to remove a tattoo. Do not attempt to remove a tattoo yourself. For instance, you hop on your motorcycle and you hop off on the asphalt and see if the tattoo will vanish. Not a good plan. You really need help with this.
Ow.
Tip number seven, don't use henna for a temporary tattoo. It is a hair dye. It is not approved for tattooing, and it can lead to severe scarring and permanent reactions in people who are allergic. This is not an allergy you want to find out about, so we do not recommend henna tattoos, nor does the FDA. Number eight, don't attempt to give yourself or others a tattoo.
You're welcome, Tony.
Yeah, that just seems obvious, but please. Too many things can go wrong when you attempt to give yourself a tattoo. This is just a bad idea.
The thing is it would be very odd for me to come at you with a needle, but really for you to come at me with a needle would probably, we've done that before.
Yeah, I at least know about a needle, but I don't know anything about a tattoo.
Well, and you're probably not much of an artist.
Well, I think certainly working in
that
medium.
Could you draw a tree?
I'd
probably get a little stick man.
Yeah, I have used many artistic materials such as color crayons and things like that, but I have not used tattoo ink.
We can play hangman.
Let me just read number nine to you very slowly. Don't let other people pressure you into getting a tattoo, no matter how many radio shows you've done.
Really?
Don't let other people pressure you into getting a tattoo.
I wouldn't be pressuring you.
Guido Zani, psychologist in Alexandria, Virginia. Do not let other people pressure you into getting a tattoo.
I wouldn't be pressuring you. I'd just be calling you a chicken.
Yeah, I know.
There's a difference.
Number 10, do not get a tattoo over a mole. If that mole develops a problem in the future, it may be difficult to diagnose because of the tattoo.
Yeah, I would say so.
That is our top 10 tattoo tips from our sponsor.
I think, you know, like 937 would be a good show number. I mean, it'd be a 9, a 3, and a 7. It'd be easy. It'd look good.
Number 9, do not let other people pressure you into getting a tattoo. Remember, think before
number
you make.
Number 9, it's perfect.
That's our sponsor, Tattoo Tips. Now, we've got to go back.
And
let's just remind ourselves where we left. We were talking about zipper injuries.
We were right on the edge of the gutter.
Exciting thing to talk about. And they had some management strategies. And I thought, my goodness, wouldn't it be nice if we just gave you some management strategies in case the manly part gets caught in the zipper.
So, Tony, before we get too deep in this, I got to ask you, did you instruct your male child about the potential zipper injuries?
We had the talk.
You had the talk. Was it difficult?
Well, I had a pamphlet.
Did you? You know, that was before YouTube videos, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's any YouTube videos on this one, Rick. I think they got pulled off.
There were several movies that exploited that I watched. And I was thinking, that pretty much explains why you don't want to do that.
Management strategy number one. If the skin has become entrapped between the locked teeth of a zipper, you can cut across it and basically break the bond between the different teeth. So you go across the zipper, and that tooth becomes an individual tooth.
You're telling me I should take a knife.
Well, all right. Look at your options here, Rick. There's not a good option. You're in trouble, okay? Scissors would be better, but you try to basically cut the zipper as much as you can. Now, here's the problem. If the skin is caught in the buckle of a zipper, that's the challenge.
You stop screaming.
They said a reasonable initial approach is to attempt unzipping with or without a lubricant such as mineral oil. Give it a shot. Maybe things
How about
will
slide. Tears?
If this fails owing to pain, multiple other strategies have been advocated. You can try to cut the middle bar between the two holes in the zipper, the actual mechanical thing that puts the zip together.
Right.
Cut that center bar with a wire cutter to separate the two faceplates and release the entrapped. That's one thing.
So now you're down there with wire cutters.
Or you can use wire pliers. How about this one? Techniques include wedging a screwdriver between the faceplates and trying to pry the thing apart.
That sounds good.
Or you can try just squeezing the top faceplate with pliers and try to buckle it up, and that will open up the zipper mechanism.
Why don't we just use a blowtorch?
Finally, they mention in refractory cases, you go to the emergency room and they basically anesthetize and cut out a little bit of your skin and you're free.
Oh, Tony, why on earth would you pull that out of a magazine and bring that?
I think it's an important topic that has gotten too little. 10,000 people a year present to emergency rooms. Somebody needs to talk about it. Why not
us? I'm pretty sure in 10 years of doing shows, we've not talked about it. It takes 100,000 people before we were willing to talk about it.
The casualties, the bodies pile up. Someone has to say something. Why not us? Next up, and it just
gets you sure you want to go to the next thing?
More and more exciting. This was a study that came out of Johns Hopkins.
Was this about button downs?
This was about what brand of beer is most likely to put you in the emergency room.
Any of them?
No, actually not. Alcohol use causes 80,000 deaths per year in the U.S., associated with the three leading causes of death in persons between ages 1 and 40. That's unintentional injury, suicide, and homicide. Now, here's the thing. Most people think of alcohol as you either get drunk and you're in a car crash and you die, or you kill your liver and you die. But alcohol can harm you and kill you just in trying to do everyday things. And if you want to get an idea of how it works, watch the funniest home videos or whatever. You will see drunk people trying to dance on tables, trying to do something athletic, and injuring themselves severely because of alcohol. Most recent review estimated that a one-third of injury visits to trauma centers were alcohol-related. One-third. It appears that heavy drinking, either episodic or frequent, is the most likely drinking pattern associated with alcohol-related injury. Now, this group set out to study those combination of caffeine and alcohol beverages. Their theory was they would make people do things that would put them in the emergency room. The problem was, and this was 2010, 2011, that was about the time the FDA put out a warning letter and pretty much shut down the caffeine plus alcohol industry. So they had their study ready to go, and all of a sudden, the thing they wanted to study disappeared. They decided to go ahead with the study anyway to see. If you go to the emergency room, we will ask you, do you drink alcohol? We will not ask you, did you drink alcohol before you did this stupid thing? We may ask that, but we won't write it in your chart. And we won't ask you what type of alcohol you drank before you did the stupid thing. It's just not something we do. So they, Friday and Saturday nights, around 11 o'clock, they would show up at the Johns Hopkins emergency room, and they will wait for drunk people to come in with injuries. Then, and here's the hard part, they have to wait for them to sober up.
To ask them the questions.
Yeah, so they can ask questions. So they wound up doing most of this research around 4 in the morning was the average time that they finally got to talk to the people. They asked for their permission. They asked how much they were drinking and what they were drinking, and they recorded that. And they did 105 interviews, mostly at 4 a.m. Two-thirds of them were male. Big surprise there.
Yeah, right.
Now, Johns Hopkins ER is an inner-city ER. Two-thirds of them were African-American.
Okay.
So that might influence their taste in alcohol. Not really certain about that. In general, a couple of surprises came up. Females consume less beer and malt liquor than males, but they had a lot more, they call them ready-to-drink alcoholic beverages.
You mean you twist the cap off?
Yeah, these are flavored malt beverages, brandy, cognac, gin, rum, scotch, tequila, vodka, whiskey, cordials, and liquors. I don't know.
I'm surprised like wines and spritzers weren't on there.
Oh, listen, wine does not put you in the emergency room. Let's just go ahead and just get that off the table right now. Nope. Lower level of alcohol consumed among those involved in motor vehicle crashes. People who were in car crashes were twice as likely to mix caffeine with the alcohol. What you do is you either don't drink much when you drive, or you try to mix caffeine with it to try to make up for the fact that you're drunk. You do not get rip-roaring drunk and drive. Apparently, people don't do that. But they'll do just about anything else. Now, you want to know brands. You want to know what is the leading brand of alcohol that will put you in the emergency room. Budweiser turns out to be the king of injuries.
Now, is that specific to Budweiser brand, or does that include all of them, like Bud Light? You know,
That is Budweiser beer. That was 15% of all ER trauma injuries drank Budweiser, and they only have 9% of the national beer market. So they were overrepresented in this group.
Okay.
There's something called Steel Reserve, which is a malt liquor. They came in second. See, they were 14.7% of the beer consumed in the ER, only 0.8% of the beer market. So if you're drinking Steel Reserve malt liquor, you're probably going to wind up in the ER. Top five brands of alcohol consumed were all beer, followed by Barton's Vodka, ranked number 6. And I'll give you the top 10 here. Budweiser, number 1. Number 2, Steel Reserve. 3, Colt 45.
Yeah, no surprise there.
4 is Bud Ice. 5 is Bud Light. 6 is Barton's. And 7 is Miller Lite, the first non-Budweiser, just straight beer,
right.
I think, on the list.
Pilsner. American Pilsner.
Yeah.
Let's talk intelligently about,
which I can't do.
It's an American Pilsner.
Guinness was number 8, Smirnoff number 9, and Corona Extra number 10.
Smirnoff, that wouldn't even be a beer. That would be some kind of a, I guess you could call it a, yeah. I thought you said malt beverages, though.
No, malt beverages were, again, beer and malt beverages were the top 5.
Okay.
Then you got to Barton's, which is a vodka. Then you got Smirnoff coming in at number 9, a vodka. But everything else is beer. So pretty much, if you want to wind up in the emergency room with a significant injury, it looks like the Budweiser family of beers is the best way to get yourself to the emergency room. And an interesting piece of research, actually, as it turns out. And obviously, the women had a different viewpoint, but apparently it's hard liquor, and wine was not anywhere on the list. I guess people who drink wine don't do it. The other thing that was surprising, bourbon was underrepresented. That is, the bourbon has a higher share of the market than it does a share of the ER population. You can argue that maybe people who drink bourbon don't do things. People who drink bourbon are wealthier and stay at home. But bourbon is relatively underrepresented in the ER and Johns Hopkins.
Well, I mean, I think it's been my experience some 25 years above the legal limit that typically it is very traditional for a person to start off in the malt beverage wine area and then migrate into the clear, you know, the vodkas and the gins. And then possibly even then start into the rums. Ultimately, as they get older and older, you go from bourbon to whiskey to blended whiskey to like a single malt scotch. I mean, you basically see that transition as your palate changes.
So you're figuring beer is the preferred beverage of young people.
Yes.
And young people wind up in the emergency room.
Yes.
Older people, when they drink, they mainly sit around.
Yes. Or they're doing less opportunity for injury.
I could buy that. I could see.
I mean,
that.
You know, they're out, maybe they're in a boat, but, you know, they're not going fast as to where the youth would be water skiing. They probably aren't riding a jet ski, although they could be, but they may not be. That sort of thing. You know, maybe, you know, where I would say the bourbons and the scotches, they may result in things like, you know, just accidents of judgment, you know, where you do something that's just, you know, it's not necessarily you hurt somebody else because you make a bad decision.
Well, and they mentioned at the end of the article, they said, well, you know, we should look at this and it might inform our taxation on alcoholic beverages if one is more likely to put you in the emergency room. But if you're right, Rick, and this is simply the beverage of choice among young people versus older people, then selectively
taxing, change the preferred drink.
Yeah. Selectively taxing young people's beverages of choice does not seem to be a very good strategy. So I don't know what to make of it. I think one thing I firmly believe is this thing begs to be replicated in rural Kentucky.
No. You're thinking here, I'd like to see it compared against a country where drinking isn't restricted like a Germany. I'd like to see them take these numbers and translate them into a German environment where the kids can drink at 5. I'd like to see if there is a predominance, you know, how this breaks down in a totally different environment that's, again, not where limits aren't imposed.
Well, I will say, I think it's unlikely we'll see any of this because the original purpose of the research was really, I think, to find out about these energy alcohol combinations, caffeine alcohol combinations. When that went away, I think a lot of the enthusiasm went out, although they, to their credit, they did complete the study just as a kind of a trial to see whether or not you could find out beverages from people who presented the emergency room. They were successful in that regard. The findings are interesting, but unlikely to be repeated, in my opinion. Rick?
You got time for one more.
All right. Traditionally, the causes of adult cardiovascular disease. This is from a journal I never read, but I saw a summary. It's called Future Cardiology. It was the September 2013 issue. When you think about cardiovascular disease, there are two risk factors we talk about. One is genetic predisposition.
Right.
Things that run in your family. And two is lifestyle. What do you eat? How much exercise you do? Do you smoke?
Do you drink?
And so forth. Yeah. There is another possibility, the impact of early life events as a third important domain. Now, I don't know much about early life events. I do not ask my patients about early life events to try to determine their risk of cardiac disease, but I'll accept that that's their premise. Now, the other thing you need to know is birth rates have been declining throughout the world, particularly in Europe and Asian countries. There has been a large increase in the number of one-child families.
Right.
And, as a result, a large increase in the proportion of first-born children, right?
Right.
Because if you only have one, that's your firstborn.
Right.
Okay. It turns out firstborn children are on the average 250 grams lighter than later-born children at birth. This reduction in birth weight has been previously noted and suggested that that might be linked to insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and cancer. You do not want to be born light, and yet firstborns are. These authors argue...
Isn't light relative? I mean, my first one was 9 pounds and something.
So you're saying, yeah, your second one may have been 250 grams heavier, but that does not mean that the first one was...
Keep going.
Yeah, I understand.
Keep going. The second one cracked 10.
Okay. So your experience comes out. The interesting thing is apparently you have a practice child. My brother, I commonly refer to him as the practice child.
Yeah, because you just can't call him a training child.
That's right.
You can have a training dog or a training plant or a training fish, but you can't have a training child.
No, but he was a practice child. He was. He's throwaway, you know, it's that sort of thing. But it may be that the first time around, the uterus is just not quite ready to develop this child.
I can live with that.
Okay. Studies have shown that the firstborn children are taller, but they weigh less, and these taller kids are more likely to develop cancer. Earlier studies, more likely to develop diabetes. 4 decades ago, firstborns were found to be at greater risk for developing hypertension, and insulin sensitivity was 21% lower in firstborn children, meaning that they had a tendency toward higher sugar. What they're saying here is it may be that some of the increase in diseases we've seen are related to the fact that we have a higher proportion of firstborn kids. I've never seen that theory advanced before. I think it's an interesting idea, and that's where I'm going to leave it. And this is where we're going to leave you. We're going to take time out for our break, and we're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. I hope you had a great break. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Marco Polio Show.
Marco.
I'm glad you finally got that.
Marco. Hey, you're opening your eyes. Close them.
This, in all seriousness, is our tribute to those polio.
Yeah, I couldn't go three segments without making a joke. I couldn't. It's very serious. I understand.
No, well,
it's terrible.
The thing is, we have a fun show here. We enjoy talking about zippers and things like that. But honestly, you have to respect the dedication of people who go into these
hazardous
situations. And let's expand that. I do not know of any nurse who has been in acute care more than 3 years, who has not had some form of physical assault. These are people who are drunk, people who are on drugs, elderly people who are demented.
Right.
And I admire people in the front lines of healthcare, whether they're vaccination workers who risk their lives going into these third world countries, or whether they're right down the street in your emergency room who risk their lives going to work at night, knowing that people are going to come in who are mentally disturbed or inebriated and don't know what they're doing. It happens every day in every hospital. Don't kid yourself. These specialties, nurses and these emergency room doctors, there is a palpable danger on Saturday nights in many busy emergency rooms across the nation.
Tony, think about it. I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, when were we ever concerned about people going out giving vaccinations? I mean, we're talking about a vaccination, something that everybody in the whole wide world knows cures people or prevents people from getting a potentially deadly, fatal disease.
The two problems, the boycott in Nigeria occurred because they did not trust Western governments. They felt that this vaccine was, in fact, designed to make them sterile, to try to keep them from reproducing, and they boycotted it, and they wound up killing these vaccine workers. Pakistan, the situation is a little bit trickier. The CIA decided to send in hepatitis vaccinators into the Osama bin Laden compound in order to confirm his identity. And so that's the equivalent of launching an attack from a Red Cross hospital.
I mean,
at that point, you have endangered the very system that you set aside and tried to make non-political.
Well, and I do think that, Tony, there was an idea behind the American Red Cross and some of the Geneva Conventions that were enacted as far as, you know, how do we treat that big Red Cross? And I think it's a sad state of affairs that you can't go into any country with a big Red Cross on you and eliminate the possibilities of being a target.
Yep.
I just think that's terrible.
Well, and again, nurses in the United States, emergency room personnel, in that case, these are people, I guess in both cases, these are people who are not rational people, not at their right minds, whether it's a political hatred or whether it's inebriation or dementia, for whatever reason, people get hurt. Our sponsor for the last time, Tattoo Tips, Think Before You Ink. We'll talk this time about removing a tattoo. 50% of people with tattoos wish they had never gotten tattooed. In most cases, these are people in their 40s who got tattooed as young adults. It is a slow and expensive process to remove a tattoo. Most insurance plans do not cover tattoo removal. It should only be done by a dermatologist, most of the time using a laser. These concentrated light bursts, basically, they heat up and break up the ink. If you can imagine that, heating up and breaking up ink underneath your skin is not a pleasant sensation. Sort of like hot grease falling on the skin in a very small area. Different lasers for different colors, and once again, green, red, and yellow ink, the most difficult inks to remove, and it takes 6 to 10 sessions with a laser, and there may be some scarring. There are other methods, dermabrasion and other methods, but there is no easy, painless way to get a tattoo removed. Keep that in mind. make sure that you are content with your tattoo for life, or you're ready to undergo pain and suffering. That's that's our tattoo tips. Think before you ink. Rick, I got stung this summer.
I get stung all the time. Oh, you mean bees? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I have several farm ponds. I was working clearing some brush. I was wearing
knee-high wading boots. You're aggressive.
Well,
you're threatening.
I wore these knee-high wading boots, and apparently I stood on a yellow jacket's nest.
Okay.
They began stinging the boots, which is a no concern to mine, except that they got thoroughly angry, and they came in and started stinging me. So I was interested.
How many are we talking? 10, 50, 100? More than you could count?
Yeah, I know of about 8 or 10 stings. I felt individually 8 or 10 stings. At that point, I was not really counting anymore.
Wow.
Running for my life. Dog got stung a couple of times. Felt bad about that. I hate to see my dog get stung. This is Mark Ibadi of Colorado Allergy and Asthma Center. He spoke at a conference on internal medicine talking about stinging insect reactions. Who needs referral to an allergist? And he makes this point. He said, if I see a patient who's been stung and has an incredibly swollen hand, neck or leg due to a bee sting, I see those every summer. I tell patients, this is what Dr. Mark Ibadi said. I tell patients, if you're stung on your hand, even if it swells all the way up to your arm and up your neck, that's still a local reaction. That is not the kind of reaction that will lead you to go into shock, even a big, big swollen hand. You're supposed to react to a bee sting. The bee puts venom in there that makes your hand swell.
So why is my neck supposed to do it?
Well, what happens is that venom tracks up, and so you get swelling around the sting, even if it goes considerable distance from the sting, as long as it is related to the sting. Still, that's not an allergic reaction. That's simply you are sensitive to that bee venom. It's doing what it was designed to do.
So have you ever had to deal with many bee stings?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, interestingly enough, I've been stung, I don't know, a handful of times in my life that I can remember. Never really in anything of an incident. But bee stings are kind of scary in the fact that, you know, you can have 10 and the 11th one can be totally different. And you can be allergic to it, which I find that terrifying, really.
Yeah. Here's his concern. If you have a person who gets stung on the foot and a few minutes later their face starts swelling or they have a widespread throughout their body reaction, that is an allergic reaction to the bee sting. You see the difference.
Right.
You stung on the hand, your hand swells. Your hand swells up your arm swells. That's a local reaction.
Right.
You're stung on the foot, you start swelling all over. That's an allergic reaction. That goes to the emergency room. And he said, I'm quoting Dr. Mark Ibadi, the standard of care in internal medicine for a bee sting anaphylaxis is referral to a specialist for testing and desensitization. You cannot just take an EpiPen and carry it with you if you've had that type of allergic reaction. You really need specialty help for that. And that's the one message about bee stings. A big swollen hand, take some antihistamines, soak the hand, see your doctor if you need to, but that's not an allergic reaction. That's a bee sting. On the other hand, if you're stung on one part of your body, you swell all over or you swell very distant to that, not next to it, that is an allergic reaction, and that can get out of hand. You really need to be desensitized because the next time it could be life-threatening. I think that is a great, simple tip to tell you you need to go to the emergency room. You need to get to a specialist if you have that type of reaction to a bee sting.
I'm thinking I'm just going to stay indoors.
Well, and I think around here in Kentucky...
I'm a computer guy, so this works.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Around in Kentucky, I think...
You're the one who took me outside and made me think it was fun out there.
The hornet's nest and the wasp's nest and the yellow jacket's nest reach a lethal size by August and September. You can get stung in the springtime. You can get stung anytime it's warm. But I think this is the time when you could get pretty seriously stung.
Right. You can get attacked.
Yeah. And allergic reactions, they occur off one sting as easily as a bunch of stings. But like I said, just thinking about the yellow jackets, I thought, let's remind ourselves, these are the ones that we really need to get to the allergist. Talk to your doctor if you're concerned about a sting, but seek help immediately if you begin swelling somewhere other than where you were stung. A bad swollen hand is not necessarily an allergic reaction. Next up, just wanted to let our radio fans know, August 15th, the Chicago Tribune reported that Illinois' teens will be banned from using indoor tanning beds starting January 1st. Previously, kids under 14 were banned, and 14 to 17 if you have parental permission, and some cities already have policies that ban all minors from using tanning beds. The state itself has signed a bill into law, the governor has, that will ban teenage tanning altogether starting January 1.
Is that only in a public place? Or, I mean, can they tan at home if you have personal?
Obviously, you can't control that, but they cannot use tanning salons. So they cannot tan at a
business. A person can't tan another one unless they're overage.
Yeah. The opponents of the bill said this measure could push young people into riskier practices like using unregulated machines at people's homes or spending more time in the sun. And I thought to myself, honestly, you consider spending time in the sun to be riskier than indoor tanning.
No way.
I'm not buying that.
No, I will not.
That, to me, is not a riskier behavior. The sun does not change its lamps. I think, first of all, I mean, we understand the standard dermatology line. You really need to not spend a lot of time in the sun. You really need to sunblock as much as you can. Get out early in the morning. Don't get out at midday for the sun. We understand all that. But the idea that getting out in the sun is riskier than going to a tanning bed, I do not accept.
Yeah.
Simply don't.
To me, the tanning bed can be done year-round. I think a lot of people don't get out in the sun in the wintertime, although you certainly can get some sun in the winter. But so to me, the tanning bed could actually be more access to it.
Higher radiation dose. And you, as a father of teenage daughters, know you've seen some of the teenagers that have used the tanning beds.
Absolutely.
And they are a very uncomfortable color.
And, you know, the thing is, Tony, and I don't know why we don't talk about this more. There's some taboo things we just don't say around people we know or people we've seen. But, I mean, have you ever been able to look at somebody and not tell they've been to a tanning booth?
Well, that's a good point.
I mean, come on. I mean, you got a nice tan about you, but it is September, or, you know, it is the middle of the winter, and I'm pretty sure that you didn't get that laying out. And so, I mean, I don't know. Some of those things have always driven me a little crazy.
Kentucky right now does require parental permission. That is a joke.
Yeah, right.
It has no effect whatsoever on the tanning practices of teenagers. Illinois joins California and Vermont in banning tanning bed use by those younger than 18. 27 other states regulate, and Kentucky is one of those states, but we are unimpressed. Just a reminder, melanoma, the least common but most deadly skin cancer, 5% of all cases of skin cancer, 75% of all skin cancer deaths. In 2013, there will be about 77 new cases of melanoma in the U.S. and almost 10,000 deaths. There will be approximately 150 deaths in the state of Kentucky, according to the National Cancer Institute, due to melanoma this year. People under age 45, one quarter of all melanoma cases. The incidence has doubled since 1973, but the death rate has been stable since 2000. Melanoma, the leading cause of cancer death in women ages 25 to 30. The fifth most common cancer in men, seventh most in women of all age groups. We believe people who use tanning beds before age 35 are 75% more likely to develop melanoma. Those who begin before 25 may double their risk. That's why we are interested in trying to keep teens out of the tanning bed practice.
I don't know. How many times can we talk about it? I don't know. It's amazing.
I think Kentucky ought to have a law.
Right.
West Virginia looked at a law at a teenage ban. I think it's time for Kentucky to have a teenage ban. Again, this is simply these teens do not know the long-term sequela of this. I don't think they're in a position. There's too much pressure to look tan, look dark from their peers, and it leads them to make bad decisions.
The thing is, though, is it's also, to some extent, even in Kentucky, they got to get the parental consent. And, yeah, granted, it's not terribly difficult to get around that or to deal with that, but still there is an element that the parental consent is required, and the parental consent seems to be happening the parents don't seem to be concerned. And I guess that's the bigger problem to me, is I don't think we as a society have figured out that these things aren't good for you.
Isn't it frustrating?
It is extremely frustrating. I mean, now granted, if anybody who knows me wants to call me a hypocrite, I'm perfectly open to that, because I'm pretty sure a quarter pounder with cheese isn't good for me, but I like them.
Right. Pay $5, call Rick a hypocrite. That's a great fundraiser for National Public Radio. Send in your $5, and we will put you on the air.
And believe me, I'm the first to say that some of the stuff I'm spewing should turn and look in the mirror. But it's just weird. When I choose to eat that burger or make that decision, it's me. We're still talking about letting our children do this. And that's where I guess I'm trying to make the distinction. Is it's the parental consent thing isn't working because the parents don't seem to care either.
Right. Well, your daughter's feeling pressure, and it's generally the daughters, I think. I don't know the instance of tanning among boys. I cannot believe that teenage boys are tanning in large numbers.
Well, when I drive by, I don't see a bunch of boys running in.
That's right. And so I think this is a girl thing, and I think there is an incredible amount of pressure on these young women to tan. And so they are not able to assess it independently. And you're right. The parents, they want to do just like buying an ATV. They want to please their children. They want to make sure that they're not perceived to be too hard on them or whatever, and they're allowing this practice to go on. And in their defense, a lot of parents don't realize the danger. I will tell you, as a physician, you see too many melanoma cases. 150 deaths a year.
Right.
And these are young people dying of melanoma. This is not so much an older person's disease. It is a very common cancer among young people. Why in the world would we take that chance? Why not just go ahead? Let's step in. Let's take care of this. This is a good use of government. There are a lot of bad uses of government. But this right here, keeping teens from being exposed to carcinogenic radiation, is a darn good reason to have a government and have a ban.
Yeah. You know, and again, I hate climbing up onto the soapbox and sounding like a hypocrite, because I know there are times where it certainly can come off that way, because neither of us live a perfectly healthy lifestyle. You know, we don't do the things that sometimes we preach about. But in this particular case, we try to do the right things by the people we're entrusted to take care of. And it's just frustrating at times to see that we can talk and talk and talk as a nation. I'm not saying health matters. I'm saying, you know, we're not bringing up anything that's not in the modern media.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is not something that we're just on a rant. I mean, this is a trend that's happening across the nation, yet people aren't catching on as quickly as we would hope.
According to the CDC, this was reported actually back on August 19th, 29% of white high school girls went to an indoor tanning parlor at least once a year, and 17% frequently at least 10 times during a 12-month period. So this is, as Rick mentioned, this is not us picking on something that never happens. This, in fact, is a very common occurrence, and it's unfortunate. Speaking of unfortunate, unfortunately, we have run over. Rick, can you get us off the show today?
Sure can, Tony. Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Asa Hosoda, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters can cause a rare but serious condition called lactic acidosis, which can cause death. Lactic acidosis is a medical emergency and must be treated in the hospital.
Stop listening to Health Matters and call your doctor right away if you get any of the following symptoms, which could be signs of lactic acidosis.
You feel very weak or tired.
That's right. Stop and call your doctor right away. You have unusual, not normal, muscle pain.
You have trouble breathing.
You have unusual sleepiness, or you sleep longer than usual.
You have sudden stomach or intestinal problems with nausea and vomiting or diarrhea.
And I'm sorry, Rick. That's right. If you sleep longer than usual, you should call your doctor right away.
I think enjoy it.
If you feel cold, especially in your arms or legs, call the doctor.
If you feel dizzy or lightheaded, guess what? Call your doctor.
If you have a slower, irregular heartbeat.
Listening to Health Matters with meals can help lessen the common stomach side effects that usually happen at the beginning of the show. If you have unusual or sudden stomach problems, talk with your doctor. Stomach problems that start later in the show may be a sign of something much more serious.
These are not all possible side effects of Health Matters. For more information, ask your doctor or pharmacist.
You may also report your side effects to, guess who? The FDA.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.